Welcome back to the Gardening with Joy and Holly radio show. Tasha Greer moments away, but first, a product that your garden and your plants will love if you add it for them to grow with.
Are you worrying about your plant growth? Provide your plants with what they need to grow their potential. Simple Grow offers 100% organic worm castings at SimpleGrow.com. Unlike other worm casting products, when you order from Simple Grow, you're getting 100% worm castings, not filler plus castings. Promote ideal soil structure and aeration with Simple Grow, all natural and odor-free worm castings. There's only one ingredient, worm castings. No chemicals or additives will seep into your food, and it doesn't smell like other fertilizers. For indoor and outdoor use, order by the bag, bundle, ton, or truckload. Check out Simple Grow 100% worm castings, what they can do for your plants, and order today at simplegrow.com.
Well, Holly, let's go to the Proclamation Hotline, brought to you by Proclamation Goods, and bring in our guest for this week.
Tasha Greer is a homesteader and writer focused on simple and sustainable living. She is the author of Grow Your Own Spices and blogger on simplestead.com. Welcome to the program, Tasha.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to join us on the program and enlighten us, not only Holly and myself, but all of our listeners across the country.
So you called.
I'm really glad to be here.
Fantastic. So you call yourself a homesteader. What is the biggest miscommunication you have found about people who look at some who label themselves as homesteaders?
Well, I can't speak for everybody that's a homesteader, but I actually call myself an epicurean homesteader. So I'm kind of a moderate homesteader. And I think what a lot of people, you know, they always ask me, well, you must spend all of your time working really hard and doing hard work. And I'm like, no, I actually have a really good time. I get to play with animals and play out in the garden and cook exciting foods. And so I think the misconception is that this is a hard lifestyle. And that hasn't been my experience. I think it's just really a fun and pleasurable way of living.
Would you agree that it is as hard as you allow it to be?
I think so. There's certainly, you know, there's a lot of hard ways to do this, but, you know, so you could definitely make it hard and complicated. And, but, you know, I think if you know how much time you've got, if you know what your interests are, if you understand your, your goals and try to sort of replace some of the things that you really value in your life already, then you can have a good time doing it.
Now, you have animals on your property and you have land to support those animals. As we are in spring now and we see the farm stores getting the baby chickens and other animals, and people are like, oh, I want it. What is the checklist that someone needs to go over before they make that impulse decision to buy that baby chick or that baby rabbit or whatever that animal is for themselves or their kids?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because the first time I I went to the tractor supply, I saw a few ducks. I thought, oh, I'll just bring them home. And I was not prepared. And so I realized then that it probably would have been a good idea to do a little bit of research in advance to really sort of understand what their needs were, what kind of care I was going to have to give them. So I think for new people who are just kind of, you know, seeing those adorable chicks, you really want to make sure that you're prepared with a brooder. They're going to need to be warm, you know, some sort of lit, warm place or safe. Completely, because even like things like rats or things could get your little baby chicks. So you can't just leave them out. And then even as they age, you know, until they're 6 or 7 months old, they're not really fully mature. They don't have sort of all their mental faculties yet. And you have to really give them good juvenile protection, kind of treat them like, between toddler and a teenager. You have to kind of help them grow up, kind of. And then once they are mature, you still always have to worry about predators. I mean, possums, raccoons, dogs, even sometimes cats, if you have a bantam breeds, can be a problem. So you're going to need to get them secure living accommodations for their entire life cycle. And I think a lot of people don't realize that chickens, you know, if you get a hybrid chicken, they might be really productive for about 2 years, having lots of eggs. And then after that, they, you know, they kind of don't lay anymore. So you might have to cull them, or you usually can't find people who want to take non-laying chickens. So you usually have to kind of have a plan for processing them. So if you don't want to deal with that, then you might want a heritage breed. They won't lay as much, but they will lay longer, and so you won't have to think about that for a long time. So there's just a lot of things to consider when you're getting chickens or ducks or any kind of livestock. And so if you can do some research and preparation and not just be, you know, wowed by how adorable they are, I think you will be more prepared and not as stressed.
Now, you say that the chickens, they may not lay as long as you expect them to, and you have to figure out what to do with them, whether butchering them out or so to speak. Now, is the meat still fairly, I guess, good to eat? Because I know in the hog world, a sow that's had multiple litters of pigs, it's not the best eating meat. That's why they usually turn that into sausage. Is chickens that are only a couple years old that's done laying eggs, are they still pretty good to eat?
Well, they certainly can be. I mean, they can still taste really good, but there's usually, most people call them spot chickens at that point because it's not going to be a very tender meat. But, okay. You know, if you get out your slow cooker, it can still have, they taste sometimes better when they're older, but because they've, you know, got more developed muscles and just a lot more full flavored. But yeah, you definitely have to cook them longer.
Thank you. So your book, Weed Free Gardening, looks intriguing. Many people try to have a weed-free garden. Maybe they do so well. Maybe they don't do so well. What is something in your book that would encourage our listeners to check it out and find success?
Thank you for bringing up my new book, Weed Free Gardening. I think the really big misconception that people just miss with weeds is that they think that they're like a plant that shouldn't be there. And in our gardens, you know, I mean, we don't want them there, but nature puts them there for a reason. And nature, I mean, that is as a system of life. You know, there's all this stuff going on underneath the soil that we can't see it, but it still exists. And so the weeds that come up are, they're germinated because some condition in the soil was met. So maybe there was a pH change, or perhaps there was a sudden, you know, rush of nitrogen, or maybe there was, you know, some kind of digging animal underneath there that was disturbing the seeds and, you know, caused a little weathering, and so they germinated. So when weeds come, there's a reason that they arrive. And so if you can stop and figure out the reason and what sort of underlying instability is taking place in the soil, then you can address that instability and prevent more weeds from coming. I think a lot of people just rip out the weed and then more come, and then they rip out those weeds and then more come, and it's really just awful perpetual cycle of weeding. But if you could address the soil and deal with the actual issue that causes the weeds, then you can really start to ramp up your gardening. I think another big issue is that a lot of people don't realize that most soil does not have enough carbon in it, because it's, you know, we haven't had enough root systems in there. We haven't used deep enough, you know, plants that root deep enough. And so the plants aren't putting enough carbon into the soil. So you need more carbon than you think. And so you've got to really add a lot of compost. You got to use mulch, and you need to use those intelligently because they can also cause weeds. So I think my book, I try to address sort of all of these factors that contribute to causing weeds and the way that you can successfully use amendments to control them.
Definitely. So we are speaking with Tasha Greer, homesteader, author, and focused on sustainable living.
Now, you on your homestead, you harvest many things. And one thing that people may not think about harvesting is water. How do you harvest the water in your homestead, and are there any rules or laws that you need or should follow or scoot around in order to do it, quote unquote, legally?
That's a great question. I think my background is kind of, I got really interested in permaculture, so I kind of knew going into setting up a homestead that one of the very first things you have to think about is water. Especially when you're in a rural area and you can't just turn on the tap and get an endless supply. So, you know, if you were starting a new property, you definitely need, you know, some kind of well or something for drinking water. But you don't usually want to use a well for watering a massive garden. So a lot of times you'll end up setting up ponds, or you'll collect rainwater from all of the roofs of your structures. And in a rural area, you don't have a whole lot of rules to to contend with. But anytime you start digging, you have to be concerned about utilities. You have to be concerned about hydrology of the land. I mean, there you can actually sort of destabilize and cause problems if you don't understand your soil before you start digging. But when you live in more populated areas, there can even be regulations on, you know, harvesting water through rain barrels or doing irrigation. You may have to, you know, be away from your neighbor's property. If you have, sometimes if we're digging, you know, like a rain garden or something like that, and your gardener next door was relying on water that was running off your property and then all of their plants died, then you could have a neighbor problem. So really, before you start harvesting rainwater, you need to understand your landscape. You need to also pay attention to your neighbors and work with your local regulators to find out what problems are. But then you'll want to think of as many ways as you can to harvest water. So definitely ponds are a good tool, rain gardens, swales, kugel cultures, rain barrels, your house, you know, any way you can harvest water is good. Just unless you live in a really rainy area and never ever have to worry about rain, then you're probably going to want to have a reservoir so that you're not drawing on your well or you know, just having a really expensive water bill trying to maintain a garden and a food forest or whatever it is that you're growing and all of your livestock, of course, as well.
Definitely. So you teach courses on edible landscaping. What is edible landscaping and how can one start incorporating it into their yard?
That's a great question. Right now I'm on rural property and so I kind of do whatever I want. But when I actually started homesteading, I was living in the suburbs in a highly regulated housing development and I couldn't just put like rows of crops out of my front yard or even my backyard because the neighbors make some about this. So edible landscaping is really sort of a way to get around any regulations. They're basically making your food look like an ornamental garden, look like what your neighbors are expecting your yard to look like. So what you end up doing is substituting like, you know, trees in for, you know, other trees and fruit shrubs and berries and herbs and things in for the other decorative plants that you would normally use. And you maybe mix in some containers and just really sort of try to upscale the way that you're growing food so that it looks like an ornamental garden. You also need to avoid some things that your neighbors might not like, such as mulberries or berries with thorns that might, you know, cause problems for their pets. But there are a lot of really good options. I mean, rosemary, lavender, those are choices. They're very beautiful. Elderberry, the wild ones, you maybe don't want to go there, but there are some more cultivated varieties, like a cut-lace elderberry. And there's also aronia, that's a beautiful native shrub that's some really like superfood berries. Lettuces, strawberries, chard, kale, these are all really beautiful potatoes. You have a long growing period and they can kind of fill in the sort of the space in your existing landscape.
Absolutely. Well, we greatly appreciate the time you've offered us, Tasha. How can people find out more about you and get your new book?
So the book is actually, I've got Grow Your Own Spices and Weed Free Gardening, and both of theirs are available at booksellers everywhere. And the publisher is actually Quarto, so you can find them at Quarto Knows, and they're also selling it. But, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore, anybody will have those. But if you want to see some pictures of my homestead and find out more about what I'm doing, you can go to simplestead.com. Or if you're on Instagram, I'm at Explore Simplestead. And so it's like Simple Homestead Practice or Simplestead.
Simplestead.com, simplestead.com. Well, Tasha, we greatly thank you for the time you've offered us and the education that you've provided Holly and myself and all of our listeners.
Well, thank you guys for the great work you're doing.
Well, thank you very much.
For more information, please visit thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com.